We're going to be ambitious this morning in our study through the book of Genesis and try to tackle two chapters, Genesis 36 and 37. We will not read Genesis 36, but let me summarize it for you. Genesis 36 contains the genealogy of Esau, of course, Jacob's twin brother. Even if you glance quickly over that chapter as I'm speaking, you will notice, first of all, what it obviously does contain. It contains many generations of people who, over time, become a great nation. Esau's descendants include many chiefs over tribes, many kings even, and the lands that they rule over are considerable. They achieved great success in their time, in their space. This reminds us that God, for one thing, did keep his promise to Abraham in Genesis 17 to make him the father of many nations and of many kings. However, secondly, as you just even scan over Genesis 36, you'll notice what obviously it does not contain: any names other than perhaps Esau's, which you probably are familiar with. This is because Esau chose to reject God and so plunged himself and his posterity into the darkness of life without God. God, who is the source of life. There is no life, no real, meaningful, eternally significant life without God. In other words, God is also keeping his promise to Abraham in Genesis 12 that I will bless those who bless you and curse him who dishonors you. There is, however, and this is interesting, this notable possible exception. I just mentioned this for your further study and interest. In Genesis 36:11, where the two names Eliphaz and Teman are put together. Now, later in the book of Job, Eliphaz the Temanite will play, of course, a major role, which suggests that perhaps the story of Job actually takes place in the land of Edom that is described here, and against the backdrop of the descendants of Esau. And if this is the case, how much greater our appreciation for Job's righteous living, his prayerful parenting, and his faith, of course, in the one true God. If this is the backdrop against which he is living. And what a sweet reminder that God can draw people to himself, even though they may come from unbelieving, rebellious, sinful family tree on every side. But back to Esau. While Esau, as we've already seen in the book of Genesis, and many of his descendants, as we see in Genesis 36, do achieve a certain kind of notice, a certain kind of success in their day and in their circles of influence, God is not impressed with, God is not approving of efforts that are at their core rejecting him as Creator and Lord. So let me just pause there and ask you, does this Esau-like spirit characterize your endeavors this past week? Trying to succeed, trying to gain whatever kind of success it may be that you are seeking, but without God and without God's plans, priorities, or purposes? Or maybe, does this Esau-like spirit even characterize all your life? Everything that you've been living for, everything that you've been sacrificing for, everything you've been dreaming toward. striving to build your own kingdom, striving to build your own name, work toward your own goals, rather than striving for Christ's kingdom, to lift up Jesus' name, to submit to His priorities in your and for your life. Esau-like people are all over the place still today, of course. We know that. We see it in the magazines that you read, the movies that you watch, the social media accounts that you follow. They may include your supervisor or your college professor, your coworkers or your classmates. And they may seem at first blush to be very impressive to you, achieving great fame or financial prosperity, or at least getting ahead in your little circle that you're living in and moving and breathing in. However, this is what we're reminded of from Genesis 36. 10,000 years from now, only one person alive today will still be living. Will still be aware of what happened in Cincinnati, Ohio in 2017. 10,000 years from now, only one person will still be alive, and his name is Jesus. And the only efforts that he is impressed with, the only efforts that he cares about, the only efforts that he's willing to prosper eternally are those which recognize him as your Lord and Maker, because he is your Lord and Maker. Remember this then as you read Genesis 36 on your own in your private devotions. All these very impressive people who spanned a great many generations and ruled over a significant portion of land, chiefs, kings, they are merely mentioned here because of their connection to the believing patriarchs, and then almost immediately forgotten. Genesis 37 and following, the rest of the book of Genesis, then, could hardly be a greater contrast to Genesis 36. From here to the end of the book in Genesis 50, so Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, God will share in painstaking detail the life and labors, the trials and triumphs, the struggles and success of just one man, Joseph. Instead of just a bird's eye sort of quick review of generations and kings and chiefs and all this, instead he's going to spend chapters telling the story of one man who believed in him and was faithful to him. And for that matter, we could go on and say the books of Exodus and all the way through Deuteronomy are a contrast to Genesis 36 also, as they record God's special favor and blessing and concern for Jacob's descendants, who were much of that time slaves in Egypt or wandering around in the wilderness, likely during the same period that Esau's descendants were becoming chiefs and kings over their own lands. So they're ascending in every way that the world cares about. And Israel, it seems for all the world, in general, is descending in their importance in every way that the world cares about. Yet, as we read through the rest of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, we see the intimate care and provision, supernatural intervention of God on behalf of those who trust in Him. Better to be a slave under God's care and protection than a king who is relying on your own strength and resources for success. Better to be a slave with God than a king by yourself. Certainly, we learn this lesson over and over again in Scripture, but nowhere more clearly than in Joseph's life, whose story begins in Genesis 37. As we read, first of all, that Joseph is given dreams in verses 1 through 11. Secondly, that Joseph is betrayed in verses 12 through 24. And then finally, that Joseph is sold in verses 25 through 36. But let's begin diving into the story of Joseph by reading verses 1 through 11 of Genesis 37. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." And his brethren said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth?" And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. Now, verses 1 and 2 include what we've come to call sort of the chapter introduction that we've become used to in the book of Genesis, marking another major section of the book of Genesis, and in fact, here, the final one. These are the generations of. That's been sort of a phrase, a chapter heading by which the book of Genesis is divided up. And here we come to the final chapter, the generations of Jacob. And we are told Jacob, unlike Esau, is settled in God's promised land. Jacob is following in the footsteps of Abraham and Isaac, who wandered in a land that was not their own, uncomfortable, sacrificially following God by faith. Then verses 2 through 4 provide a brief word of explanation of backdrop for Joseph's story. Jacob's second to youngest son, Joseph, is now 17 years old. Joseph shepherds the family flock along with the rest of his brothers. However, that's pretty much where their common experience ends. Immediately, we see Joseph and the rest of his brothers going in opposing directions. In verse 2, Joseph brings a bad report of his brothers to his father, which seems to be an early indication of what we definitely will see is true later in this story. He's more righteous than they are. He is more concerned for moral living than they are. Joseph, we are specifically told, is Jacob's favorite son also. Joseph and Benjamin were both born to Isaac's favorite, or Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, yet apparently Joseph is a step up even from Benjamin in his father's estimation. So Joseph is the favorite. In fact, Jacob so clearly favors Joseph that of all his 12 sons, Jacob makes a beautiful royal coat and gives it to Joseph. Now, as nice as being the favorite son sound or might sound, it actually comes with at least one obvious drawback, and that is that all your other brothers are going to have a hard time not hating you. You know, you're being treated all the time with favoritism. You're the one who can do no wrong. You're the one who gets a royal coat. You're the second to the youngest, not the firstborn, but you're being treated like the firstborn. You're being treated, in fact, better than the firstborn. While this is not excusable on their part, the temptation to jealousy overcame Joseph's brothers to the point, it says, that they couldn't even greet him with friendliness. They couldn't even bring themselves to be just basic polite to him. And into this then, you know, and over again it's saying, and this led to them hating him even more. And this led to them hating him even more. And so then into this powder keg of a situation, God steps in with a Zippo lighter in verses 5 and following by giving Joseph dreams which occasioned his brothers hating him even more, as if they didn't already hate him. They hate him. They can't even speak peaceably to him. They see him getting special treatment. They see him being what they consider tattletale, telling what they're doing wrong to their father. They hate him already, but then God throws a match on the whole thing and blows it up by adding two dreams to the pile of reasons to hate Joseph. Now keep in mind that these are not Joseph's dreams, as they might easily be misrepresented, especially in our society where everybody's encouraged to dream a dream and follow after it. These are not Joseph's dreams. They are prophetic dreams sent from God foretelling the future, which of course Joseph could not know. Just like elsewhere in the book of Genesis, these dreams are divine revelation. This is not Joseph dreaming up then his own goals, his own ambitions, and then maybe even subliminally rehearsing them in his sleep. Hey, you know, I was thinking about how nice it would be to rule over you guys, and then I had a dream about it. No, that's not what's happening here. In other words, it's not like you and me dreaming big dreams for ourselves. God sends Joseph two prophetic dreams, one with bundles of grain, the other with sun, moon, and stars, all of them with everyone bowing down to him, Joseph, and both therefore plainly indicating Joseph would be a ruler over his other family members. Now, Joseph has a gift for interpreting dreams, but you don't need a gift for interpreting dreams to interpret Joseph's dreams. His brothers, his father, everyone can see where this dream is headed. We're putting together, you know, these bundles of grain, and then all of a sudden, all of our bundles are bowing down to your bundle. And there's the sun and moon and stars, and there happen to just be 11 stars, and they're all bowing down to you. And you just happen to have 11 brothers. Yeah, everybody can see where this is headed, what the point of these dreams is. And so they hate him for it all the more. Now, these dreams, though, are not Joseph's fault. Neither do they necessarily reflect any ambition whatsoever on his part. Nowhere is there any indication that Joseph was ambitious for this kind of a role. What these dreams are, however, is God's indication of what he plans to do through Joseph. Applying the same key that Joseph gives to Pharaoh later as a gifted interpreter of dreams, the fact that the dream is repeated, he gets two dreams to the same effect, probably means that its fulfillment is imminent. In other words, this is not just something God plans to do someday, but he's, as in the case of Pharaoh later, perhaps sending two dreams because he's emphasizing this is on the verge of taking place. This is about to happen right in front of your eyes. These events are about to start unfolding. So God has a plan for Joseph's life. Joseph doesn't understand or see how it could happen yet, nor does the rest of his family. They don't even want it to happen. But as the rest of the book of Genesis will attest, God always completes His plans. God always fulfills His promises. But even as these events begin unfolding, now keep in mind, the dream is about Joseph being a ruler. And if we understand it correctly, the fact that it's two of them means this is immediately about to start rolling out. But even as these events begin unfolding, as prophesied, it certainly will not be immediate in its evidencing. In fact, the opposite will seem to be taking place. Joseph is about to be betrayed. He's about to be beaten. He's about to be sold to his enemies. It's not about to be Joseph being bowed down to. How often we are made to wonder, even as we consider Joseph's dreams and their imminent fulfillment, how often are we seeing in our own lives this same pattern? How often we are made to wonder, does God's deliverance and exaltation begin with seeming defeat and humiliation? How often does God's grand purposes for us begin with what seems the absolute end of us? Could some seeming total defeat in your life right now, in fact, be God sovereignly working to bring about His grand purposes and promises for you? Could it be possible? Joseph's story reminds us, yes, God does work in ways in which He plans deliverance and exaltation, and yet that comes by way of seeming defeat and humiliation. Far more importantly, however, we cannot help but see a parallel between God's working in Joseph's life and the way God would eventually bring victory through the Messiah. Being betrayed, being beaten, being sold will result for the Messiah in the sin-crushing victory at the cross of Jesus. Deliverance and exaltation will begin with seeming defeat and total humiliation. Can you see how practical the story of Joseph is for Moses' reading audience, Israel, the nation of Israel? Not only does it encourage them to see hope in their personal trials, but it also gives them the insight, the patience that they will need, actually, in order to wait for the Messiah who will come in God's good time, but not evidently immediately, as they might expect. And so, in preparing them in this way, prepares them to believe on the Messiah when they see similar working in and through that righteous man as they have seen already in the story of Joseph. Think about all the language that you see all over the Old Testament about the immediacy, the coming, the soon coming of this one who would crush the serpent's head way back in the very beginning, but also through whom the nations would be blessed, as promised to Abraham, and it goes on and on and on, and yet it doesn't seem that anything is unfolding that looks Messiah-like. And so, how helpful in this condensed picture of Joseph's life for Moses to show them this is not the first time God has worked this way, that He actually, yes, plans great things, but brings them about in His own slower than we might expect, yet immediately coming, and by means of humiliation, betrayal, seeming defeat at the face of your enemies. Can you see how practical the story of Joseph is for Moses' reading audience, Israel, as they await the Messiah? But also, can you see how practical this story could be for you today? Seeing hope in your personal trials, in spite of real pain and seeming purposelessness, seeming defeat, but also how practical in giving you the insight to see and believe on God's Messiah, Jesus, when you see Him fulfilling every messianic prophecy and picture in the Old Testament, including what we see here in the life of Joseph. I hope so. I hope that you can see how practical the story of Joseph is for you today. Continuing then in verses 12 through 24, we see that Joseph, after receiving these dreams, is betrayed. Verses 12 through 24. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, Here am I. And he said to him, Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, What seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, They are departed hence, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him, that is Joseph, afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him, to kill him. And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer comes. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, Some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, Let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that, Reuben said this, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, there was no water in it. In verses 12 through 17, at Jacob's request, Joseph seeks to join his brothers who are watching over flocks in another region. He doesn't know this yet, but they're some 15 miles or so away. So he begins looking for them in one place. He's found wandering around in that place and given directions so that he can eventually find his brothers. It's striking that in this entire chapter, which chronicles really the beginning of Joseph's deep, deep trials, Joseph is himself largely passive. I don't mean that in a negative way, but Joseph is chiefly presented as the victim of circumstances outside his own control. His father is treating him like a favorite. There's nothing that says Joseph wanted to be treated that way, but his father is treating him like a favorite. His receiving dreams twice that prophesied his exalted future. His being ambushed, thrown in a pit, then sold as a slave. All this is taking place outside of his control. We might quibble about whether it was prudent of Joseph to share his dreams with his family. There's no indication that he did that out of anything more than just transparency, not necessarily out of pride or boasting. It is Joseph's father even who gives him the special coat, and it is Jacob who sends Joseph to meet his brothers and their flocks in the field. And Joseph is just replying, I'm here, do with me whatever you want. Jacob says, sure, then in that case, go do what I tell you to do. Go look after, find out what your brothers are doing. Now, although Joseph will later respond to his trials with unmistakable activity and ingenuity and responsibility and all these things, he does not seem to get into the trials in the first place through any fault or action or decision of his own. So although we make decisions, we pursue desires, we participate in the activities of life, ultimately, we're reminded in this chapter of Joseph's life, it is God who is in complete control of our lives. We will rise and we will fall. We will fail or we will succeed at God's pleasure. Joseph could not have planned for, could not have brought about the remarkable events that influenced his life so tremendously. While he is responsible to God, yes, for how he responds to these events, from the very beginning, it's evident that there is power at work in Joseph's life far beyond his own power. There's a plan at work in Joseph's life far beyond his own plan. God has promised through these prophetic dreams to make Joseph a ruler, and a ruler Joseph will be. Yet, the path will be beyond anything Joseph, or anyone else for that matter, could have possibly imagined or plotted themselves. So it's interesting to see how little Joseph actually has to do with his own story at this point in the story. How little decision-making is involved in this trial coming upon him. Thus, in verses 18 through 24, according to their own wicked hearts and thoughts, Joseph's brothers plot to ambush and kill him, their own flesh and blood. Their own flesh and blood, they plan. This is premeditated, not just in the heat of the moment. They plan to kill their own flesh and blood. It's hard not to be reminded, isn't it, back to the first fratricide in which Cain killed his more righteous brother Abel out of jealousy. In which Cain killed his own righteous brother. It's also hard for New Testament readers not to look forward, though, isn't it? To another innocent man who will be similarly mocked. So when we hear from Joseph's brothers, "Come now, let us kill him, and we will see what will become of his dreams," it sounds a lot like, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" And like, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him, for he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" Very similar parallel language, isn't it? An innocent man being mocked and accused, being plotted against. And it is hard not to marvel already, therefore, at how God is the one who, in a sense, incited these events. Let's not lose sight of that. By sending Joseph the dreams, he didn't have to do that, that stirred up the jealousy that was already in his brothers' hearts. The jealousy, the sin was already there. But God sovereignly did send information to them that he knew in their wickedness they would allow to drive them to murder. Thus, Joseph's brothers are seen to be guilty in their plotting, in their harming of their brother. Yet, God is seen to be sovereign from the very beginning of Joseph's story. We can't help but think of a New Testament scene in which wicked men with wicked hands fulfill the preordained plan of God, betraying a righteous, truly righteous man. John Piper comments, "Joseph's brothers are utterly oblivious to God's invisible hand in their action. They do not know that in the very effort to destroy this dreamer, they are fulfilling Joseph's dreams. Oh, how often God works this way, Piper says. He takes the very sins of the destroyers and makes them the means of the destroyer's deliverance. This is amazing. This is amazing even on a small scale of Joseph's life. It's astounding. It is breathtaking. It is worthy of eternal praise that God does this in every believer's life. Let me ask you, can you see the beauty of the way that God works? Even as you sympathize and truly try to sympathize with, get in the heart and shoes and life of Joseph, sympathize with his humiliation, rejoice with him in his eventual exaltation. But even as you do that, I hope you will come to see him as merely a precursor to the infinitely greater fulfillment in Jesus. For your sake, Jesus was likewise betrayed, likewise beaten, likewise sold, likewise humiliated. And just as Joseph's eventual exaltation will actually save the very brothers who betrayed him, Jesus' victory over sin and death is for the salvation of the very people whose sins nailed him to the cross. Jesus died to save sinners. Of course, unlike Joseph, Jesus did all this, went through all this willingly and intentionally for his enemies. How can you not love such a beautiful, selfless, sacrificial Savior who goes willingly, intentionally through betrayal and beating and humiliation in order to save the very ones who are betraying, beating, and humiliating him? It's a beautiful Savior that we serve, and we see the beauty of his salvation, at least in small picture form, in the story of Joseph and his brothers. So back in Genesis 37, Joseph's brothers plot to kill him, although Reuben, the oldest, steps in to intervene, suggesting instead they throw him in a pit. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean any wisdom, love, or humility, or grace on Reuben's part. He's the oldest, and as we know from actually later in this story, we know that Jacob holds the sons responsible for what happens to the other sons. And so maybe as the oldest, he's just thinking, I don't want to have to answer to my father for the blood of one of our brothers. But regardless, Reuben's plans to come later and rescue Joseph don't come to fruition. So this is interesting. Not only do the bad plans of those who are trying to harm Joseph come to pass to some extent, but even Reuben's good plans, in a way, cannot contravene the plan that God is working out in Joseph's life. So Reuben plans to deliver Joseph from the wicked hands of his brothers, and yet God providentially arranges that he's unable to, because God has a better plan in place than Reuben's. Have you ever had a good plan meet with total failure? I mean, a good plan that's for somebody else's good, maybe even for God's glory, and you think, this is just going to be awesome. I can see already the red carpet rolling out on this one, because God is going to get on board, because he obviously will see how this is good for everyone involved. And then the whole thing comes crashing down in utter failure. A child you intended to adopt and then are unable to. A godly marriage you were looking forward to, and then it does not come to consummation. A plan you had for your congregation, and it is, in one way or another, brought to ruins. Well, God is, in His wonderful wisdom, not only overruling bad plans for your good, but your good plans for your good. God is overruling your best thoughts about your life and how things ought to go and what you should do for others for your good and His glory. And we see then how things unfold in verses 25 through 36. When she was brought... Sorry, that's chapter 38. Let's go to 37. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it? Literally, now understand, this is not just a metaphorical word. This is the word meaning profit. What loot, literally, is it? If we slay our brother and conceal his blood, come, let us sell him, our brother, to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit. And behold, Joseph was not in the pit. And he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, this have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. Verse 25 says, the brothers, having just betrayed Joseph, sat down to eat. Sat down to eat. Such a simple statement, but it's clearly out of place with the horror, the guilt of what they have just done. But it's an indicator of how calloused they are, isn't it? I remember it's like reading a story many years ago in the news of gang members who executed a drive-by shooting in a family neighborhood and then calmly went from there through the drive-thru at Taco Bell. It blows the mind, the contrast of these two events, the incongruity of these two events. Doesn't it even bother them? Apparently not. They've sold they're planning on killing their brother. They have plotted against him and they sit down to eat, even as he languishes under their fierce hands. Remember how that in Genesis 34 and 35, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi were passed over in favor of Judah, actually, as ancestors to the Messiah because of their wickedness? It would not be Reuben, it would not be Simeon, it would not be Levi. It would be the fourth in line who would be the one from whom the Messiah would come. And we're specifically told the sins that Reuben, Simeon, and Levi committed. Well, here we're reminded that while our punishment is always well-deserved, our rewards are always based on God's mercy than our merit. It is none other than Judah, the one through whom the Messiah will come, who suggests that they sell their brother Joseph to slave traders heading to Egypt. And why? Not because, as he says, we don't want to kill him, he's our brother, but because, as he also says, let's get some profit from this thing. Let's get some loot from our brother by selling him down the drain into slavery so that we can benefit from it financially. John Piper points out again that although Joseph's story has so many parallels with that of Jesus Christ, this whole section of Genesis is not ultimately just about Joseph among Israel's sons, it's about Judah. The spectacular sin, Piper says, of these brothers was God's way of saving the tribe of Judah from extinction, so that the Lion of Judah, Jesus Christ, would be born and die and rise and reign over all the peoples of the world. I mean, this is amazing. Judah is, for his own greedy, selfish, jealous purposes, selling his brother into slavery, and God is overruling that for the purpose of bringing a child from Judah who will save Judah. And so Joseph's brothers sell him, their own brother. If you're familiar with this story, don't let the familiarity of that in any way reduce the obvious pain of that. Sold by your own brothers into slavery for pieces of silver. What the Messiah would feel deeply and completely, fully, Joseph, as a pointer to the Messiah, felt also, expressed in the Psalms, "It is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me. Then I could hide from him. But it is you, my brother, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend." Joseph comes to check and see how his brothers are doing, and they beat him, throw him in a pit, and then sell him as a slave. What pain Joseph must have endured to be so betrayed. And so in verses 29 through 36, Reuben discovers he can't rescue Joseph after all. So, unable to beat them, he joins his brothers in deceiving their father Jacob. They dip Joseph's coat in blood. They show it to Jacob, letting him draw the obvious inference. Here's a torn, bloody coat. They don't lie, but they deceive, clearly, their father by giving this to him. And Jacob responds with inconsolable grief, thinking his son Joseph is dead. And we cannot read past these passages and just think of these people as paper people. But to feel the pain of Joseph in being betrayed, and to feel the pain of Jacob in thinking that his own son, whom he loved so much, is dead. He is inconsolably grieved. He says, "Some horrible beast has eaten my son." I wonder how many trials losses even, we have suffered, in which we are inconsolable, because for all the world it looks like some horrible beast has devoured our loved one. But Joseph's story reminds us that God is working in ways beyond what our eyes can see, beyond what every piece of physical evidence points toward. There is no evidence for life beyond the grave. But God says that even when we mourn our loved ones and they actually are dead, and that horrible beast of death has seemingly devoured them, that is not the end. So in verse 36, the verse closes the chapter with this striking reminder of how wrong Jacob actually is. In fact, Joseph is not dead. In fact, Joseph is taken to Egypt, sold to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh. So let me conclude by just making this observation. God's plan has not been derailed. Not by evil plans, by evil people, not by well-meaning plans, not by the love of Jacob, not by the humility of Joseph. Nothing has derailed God's plan. Rather, God is sending Joseph ahead of the rest of his family in order to, unbeknownst even to Joseph yet, bring about a great deliverance for them all. God's plan has not been derailed. One more quote from John Piper. He writes, "The story of Joseph is the story of a righteous one who is sinned against and suffers so that the tribe of Judah would be preserved and a lion would come forth and would prove to be a lamb-like lion and by his suffering and death purchase and empower glad obedience from all the nations, even from those who put him to death." Does he have yours? Piper asks, and I ask you today. This God who so beautifully, this Savior who so beautifully plans and executes deliverance, grand, great, beyond our imagination deliverance from enemies that were far greater than anyone we could possibly face on our own, in order, in fact, to destroy what would otherwise have destroyed his destroyers. He dies for his enemies, so that he might purchase and empower glad obedience from all the nations. Does he have your glad obedience, given he certainly is worthy of it? If you today have not followed an obedient, joyful, public profession of Jesus Christ in baptism, we give you the opportunity to publicly do that as we sing this song. May God bless you.